Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 89213, Pennsylvania versus Munoz. Mr. Aiken, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, in this case we have a drunk driving suspect, Inocencio Munoz, who was legitimately in custody, and that is not at issue. What is at issue is what the police did with Mr. Munoz once they lawfully had him in custody. What they did is what they do with the large majority of drunk driving cases, which now number over 1,000 a year in Cumberland County, Pennsylvania. They took him to one of the central booking stations that had been set up and there turned him over to several processing agents, employees of the county whose job it is to do nothing but process drunk driving suspects. What they did was a multi-step function, all of it on videotape. They bring the individual into the room, ask him some routine booking questions, his name, his address, his social security number and such. They then follow that with several sobriety tests. They first, at this point, ask him to try to calculate the date of his sixth birthday. They ask him to walk a line, 9 steps. They ask him to balance himself on one leg while counting to 30. And they conduct the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, which measures the effect of alcohol on the function of the eye.
Mr. Aiken, may I ask you, are these regular, is this a routine that's followed with everyone?
Yes, sir.
Is it pursuant to a regulation, or is it just this particular police department?
This is the county, which encompasses probably state police, several military installations, and 20-odd local departments. The county agents do it, and they always do it the same. The latter three of the field tests are what are called the standard field sobriety tests. They're the ones that are recommended by the National Highway Traffic Safety.
You say they'd always do it the same, just by custom, not by no written regulation requires
no,
the procedure.
No, sir, not by law or regulation.
What would happen if an individual said, I won't do it?
Well, the law, we feel, would allow the police to compel them to do it, but practically speaking, there is no way you can compel a person to walk a line and get any useful information.
Does he violate any law if he says, I will not recite the alphabet or I will not tell you my sixth birthday?
No, sir. What happens is that the videotape, which is available, would indicate the circumstances of the refusal, and so the refusal may come into evidence,
right.
But there's no penalty accepting the breath test, which is the stage of the process that follows these sobriety tests is the breath test. The individual is advised that under Pennsylvania law, there is an implied consent. You have the breath test here. If you refuse to take it, you will lose your license for an additional year's time, regardless of the conviction or lack of conviction on the underlying drunk driving case. In this case, Mr. Muniz made several statements while that was being explained to him, as is required by Pennsylvania law. He refused the test eventually. At that point, he was taken again to another table. He was given his warnings under the Miranda decision, and then for the first time was asked specific questions aimed at his drinking, where he was drinking, what he had to drink, where he was coming from. The test in this case, or the issue that is to be resolved, we submit, is the distinction between those latter questions, which are clearly aimed at gaining testimonial evidence from the accused, and everything that went before, which was gained or aimed at gaining physical evidence.
Well, now, one of the questions asked at the processing stage was, I believe, what was the date of your sixth birthday.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, is that some kind of a routine question that's asked whenever the police think someone might have been drinking?
It was asked routinely in Cumberland County at the time. Since the decision by the Superior Court, it has not been asked, but it was at that time. It is asked at the conclusion of the routine booking questions and immediately before the horizontal gaze nystagmus test.
Wouldn't the information given in the response be relevant on the question of whether the person had been drinking or not?
Yes, we submit it would be, just as the...
So it could be testimonial?
No, ma'am, I don't believe it would be testimonial. It is another sobriety test. It is not aimed at determining the truth of the answer, the date of his sixth birthday. What it's aimed...
Whether he responds accurately or not is relevant.
That's correct.
And you would propose to offer it and use that against him?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. We would use it to show the physiological effect that alcohol has had on that man's brain, not to elicit the contents of his mind. The brain controls the
tongue. Why isn't that a form of interrogation?
Because the goal is not to achieve testimonial evidence. It is not to achieve...
Well, it certainly is to get evidence to use against the person to establish whether they've been drinking or not.
That's correct. Just as walking...
It's quite unlike asking the person for an address and a driver's license.
That's correct. But it is also unlike asking him, how much did you have to drink? What it is designed to show is that alcohol has affected this man's brain to the point that he cannot do basic calculations.
Well, would he have a right to refuse to answer that question? He said, I refuse to answer that question.
I suggest he probably would, just as he can refuse to answer any question.
Well, could you then put in evidence the fact that he refused to do the birthday calculation?
We would submit you can, because it is not aimed at testimonial.
Also, then he doesn't have a right to refuse to decline on Fifth Amendment grounds, at least.
Well, what he has no right to be warned of the consequences of...
No, he has no. Under your view, he has no self-incrimination right not to answer that question. Because
True.
If you say that he does, then you can't introduce his refusal into evidence.
As a practical, perhaps I'm speaking more as a practical matter than anything else, because to compel someone in that circumstance is practically impossible without the intervention.
No, the question is a simple one. Whether or not he has a Fifth Amendment right to decline to answer the question.
We would suggest he does not have a Fifth Amendment right not to answer the question.
Just as he doesn't, I suppose, in your view, to refuse to walk a line.
Yes, sir.
Although neither one can actually be compelled in a police station kind of.
Right. We have the right to compel, but practically speaking, no ability to compel.
Challenge in this case to, I guess there is, to the introducing the videotape of the physical tests?
In this case, the Pennsylvania Superior Court merely suppressed the audio portion. In subsequent cases of theirs, they have said that it would be unfair to force the defendant to choose between a video without audio, and therefore have suppressed.
Well, but how about in this case? In this case?
In this case was merely the audio that was.
Well, the demonstration that he couldn't walk a straight line, that shows what the effect of alcohol is on his physical coordination, I suppose.
Well, it, to a degree it does. In this specific case, his, explanations as to why he could not walk the line were certainly relevant. If we have the right to ask him to walk the line, I suggest his responses to that request or that demand are just as relevant as the actual walking of the line itself. And there shouldn't be a distinction between his oral refusal to do this test.
What about this eye test? Who you can't see that on video, can you?
You can, yes. We've had experts who testify. The camera zooms in such that the face of the accused...
And is that what happened in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And it shows the eye...
And what does that show?
It shows the eye tracking a stimulus, which in this case was a pencil, from side to side slowly.
And is that supposed to show that he was drinking?
Yes, sir.
Had been drinking?
Yes, sir.
So it shows the alcohol, the effect of alcohol on his eye movement.
That's correct.
Just like you say the birthday question shows the effect of alcohol on his mind?
That's correct. The question is not aimed at getting the truthful, how old were you in such and such a year. It's aimed to show that the mind is affected, not the contents of the mind, but the brain being affected by alcohol. The brain does a lot of things. It controls your feet when you walk the line. It controls your tongue when you go to talk. That's why slurred speech is one of the classic indicia that defense counsel say, well, he didn't have slurred speech when the policeman doesn't hear it. It's that classic. But it's because the brain is affected by alcohol, not the tongue itself.
May I just ask this question? You did have in this case the fact he refused to take the one test. You can use the eye movements and you can use the staggering down the line. You really need the rest of the evidence? It seems to me it almost sounds cumulative to me here, that what we're fighting about.
It may be, Your Honor, but the goal of the testing is to establish a routine that gives the best possible evidence to the finder of fact. And the three standard tests developed by the Highway Safety Council are ones that have statistically been shown to correlate to a very high degree to persons over the legal limit.
May I ask this question, too? If the issue were not whether the man was intoxicated, but say it was in a different kind of criminal proceeding, and the issue were whether he was mentally competent to stand trial or mentally competent to receive the death penalty or something like that, would you say you could perform these tests without giving him warning?
I think that would have to be in a case-by-case basis. And
why? Isn't it the same issue?
Well, there are several lower...
The question is whether the privilege against self-incrimination protects him from making these verbal statements. I don't know why the nature of the proceeding should matter.
The case I think of is the Estelle case, where the psychiatrist in that case was using the substance of what was related to him rather than forming conclusions without regard to the substance of them. If here we are to introduce for the truth of what is said, his response, that's different. And I think in the mental health cases and insanity defenses, that...
Sometimes that's true, but you could also have a case where you just want to find out how his mind works when he's asked to recite the alphabet and when he's asked about his sixth birthday and that sort of thing, I would think. I don't know.
And I think in those cases, Your Honor, it would be proper because, again, it's not testimonial in nature. It's demonstrative in nature. But if
suppose the issue is whether or not, one of the issues in the case, whether or not he can speak Spanish. And the police officers start talking to him in Spanish to see if he responds or can I ask him, do you speak Spanish?
In that case, I believe it would be proper because you're not asking for a specific fact in his mind, but merely a...
And his answer, in your view, is not used to incriminate him?
To incriminate him, but not because of the contents of his mind, just as in the Dionisio case where voice...
How do you know Spanish? You learn it in your arm? Of course you learn it in your mind, don't you?
The ability to speak Spanish certainly is contained in the mind. But if the court, as you have allowed us to take voice exemplars or to speak at a lineup, the language in which you speak is equally as non-intrusive.
Suppose this defendant is very nervous, and he takes his existing age and he subtracts 6, and then he takes that number and subtracts it from today's date. And he comes out wrong, either because he doesn't quite do it right, or because he misses a month, he uses years, and he has a late birthday. Still admissible in evidence?
I'd suggest it's admissible, but certainly the weight of it is something that is always subject.
Would he have to get on the stand to explain how he did it and why he made the mistake?
The same as he can get on the stand to explain why he didn't walk the line properly or balance properly or anything else. He can get on to explain
why. It seems to me it's qualitatively different because you're asking him to perform a mental feat that requires verbal articulation, and that's what the Fifth Amendment is designed to protect against.
Well, the cases have clearly stated that if the purpose is to get the contents of the mind, that's one thing, but the processes of the brain in being able to do basic math or recite the alphabet or things that are not in and of themselves indicative of the contents of the mind of an individual relative what they're looking for, that is different and ought to be maintained as different. The mere fact that it is an oral manifestation rather than a physical should not matter. We don't have them walk the line.
It's because the Fifth Amendment is concerned with testimonial communication. That's why we're concerned, and that's why there might be a difference.
There might
don't
be.
Don't you think the question is one that the police would reasonably expect would result in an incriminating response under these circumstances?
Only in the same level as they would expect.
There was every indication this person had been drinking. There were lots of indications he'd been drinking, staggering around and slurred speech and what have you. So they knew when they asked that birthday question, it was likely to give an incriminating response.
Just as they knew when he would walk the line, he was likely to incriminate himself in that manner, but not in a testimonial
sense. That's not an interrogation.
It's not interrogation. It's not because it's not testimonial. It is physical. It is demonstrative. But the inability to count to six is, I suggest, the same as the inability to walk six steps. The function affected is the brain. We are not asking him to disclose any information about it. The fact that he is more likely to say something incriminating or not should not inhibit the police in gathering physical evidence, which I suggest this is, just as much as walking the line.
Was he asked to recite the alphabet?
No, not in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this case was after the Bruder case in Pennsylvania, which at the time said that was improper because the contents of the alphabet were testimonial, which I suggest they're not.
Mr. Eakin, there is this difference between this case and the other non-testimonial cases that you talk about. It seems to me you're quite correct that the content of his mind is not the object of the enterprise. It's not the end that is sought, but it is the means. And in these other cases, that is, because of the current content of his mind, you know that he's drunk. You don't want to introduce the content of his mind, but the means of showing that he's drunk is finding out the current content of his mind. Wouldn't you acknowledge that difference? And that's quite different from walking a line or being compelled to give a handwriting exemplar or a voice sample or anything like that?
No, I don't.
You don't acknowledge that? Weren't you trying to find out the content of his mind? In his mind, did he know what his sixth birthday was?
No, sir. We're trying to show that his physiological ability to calculate was affected.
How do you show it? How do you show it? You show it by asking the content of his mind, and the content of his mind proves that his mind's not working right.
If
the same when he can't walk the line?
I'd suggest it is the same.
Isn't it comes from the brain?
It all comes from the brain, and what we're trying to show is not how old he was, what year he was six. That's the contents of the mind, but it's the inability to arrive at that conclusion, which is a process of the brain that is affected by alcohol. The judgment driving down the road is impaired by the alcohol, and you cannot determine, is this your street or not? Is this a place I can make a U-turn or not? It's not introduced to show what the street is, proper or improper. It's to show that the function is impaired.
I don't consider walking a line the content of the mind. That may be a function of the brain, but when we talk about the content of the mind, you mean ideas, you mean concepts. That's what the Fifth Amendment is about.
That's correct. Facts.
And this is the only kind of a situation I know of in which you are, to be sure, you don't want the content for its own sake, but you do want the content of the mind as a means of showing something else. And that differs from all these other testimonial situations, it seems to me, or non-testimonial situations.
Certainly respect that distinction if you see one, Your Honor, but I
you can give me another case where we have used the content of the mind in the sense of ideas.
Again, I fall back, as Justice White says, that taking nine steps physically, taking 9 steps mentally, neither discloses facts that that individual knows. If we'd have asked him, as we did after Wright's, were you drinking, that's a fact in his mind. That is his ability, if he slurs his words in answering, that is not testimonial. It's relevant, but it's not testimonial. It's not the contents of his mind. It's not the extortion of information from him. It's the extortion of his ability to think, not what
he... Yeah, that's his ability to move his lips. You give him a paper to read, it has nothing to do with any ideas in his mind. You give him a paper to read, and he can't move his lips. It's physical, just as the way he can't move his feet. But in order to find that he can't think correctly, you must know what the content of his mind is, what idea he has in there. So you ask him this question. Now, maybe it's okay, but it's different from all of the other testimonial cases that I know of.
It is different in that sense, I agree. But I would suggest that the mere fact that the test is an oral one rather than a physical one, strictly physical, is not the basis for the court's distinction between testimonial and demonstrative evidence. It never has been. I'd suggest never should be. The fact that no fact is disclosed here is significant. The purpose for this information is not to show the date of his 6th birthday. The Superior Court in this case felt that the routine questions were certainly all right. We had the right to ask the individual to submit to routine sobriety tests of a physical nature. They said, however, at some point during the latter, Mr. Muniz's responses became communicative in nature, and therefore Miranda came in the side door and should have been given to him at the outset. I think the record is clear that these were spontaneous remarks made in response to his instructions. They were honest. They were on videotape. They were not coercive. And the fact that he merely says something in response that is incriminating in itself does not mean that...
Well, they explained the test to him. They explained the breathalyzer test.
They explained every test to him, and his response...
And they say, do you understand?
That's correct.
And he says, no, I don't understand, and they have a big, long talk about it?
Yes, sir.
Now, you say that that is all just spontaneous? And
well, it is not the result of interrogation. Even
it says, do you understand?
That's correct.
Well, isn't that interrogation?
I suppose it's if it is interrogation, it is certainly fairer interrogation than having the test run and then having him complain that he did not understand, and that's why he didn't do it, particularly in this case where Spanish is, in fact, the gentleman's first language, English his second language. It's certainly reasonable for the police to ask him, do you understand, just as they
well,
do when they give
be.
Him...
That may be, but the question is about the statements he made in response.
No, it is not aimed at gaining testimonial evidence, again.
But it was testimonial evidence.
Well, the result, if it is...
Wasn't it?
If he expressed confusion...
Wasn't it
the result?
Testimonial
evidence? The result was testimonial.
Yeah.
But it is not interrogation because it's not designed to get that, nor is it reasonably likely to get that. The mere fact that intoxicated people might be more inclined to spill the beans on themselves than a sober person doesn't give them a greater or a different rule. It doesn't cause the police to have to be giving them different warnings or rights than they give the sober person. If the burglar with a distinctive limp is made to walk the line for witnesses, and the drunk is made to walk the line for all of us on videotape, I'd suggest the standard is the same. And just because the drunk is more likely to say something incriminating during his processing is not...
What words do they use when they ask him to walk the line? Do they say, will you do it, or please walk the line, or what do they say? What are the words?
Well, they ask him to come to the end and say, I'm going to indicate to you now how I want you to do this. Please stand there until I show you. And then the officer demonstrates with 3 or 4 steps how he wants to do it. Mr. Muniz, in this case, kept talking during the instructions.
He kept saying, the reason I can't is because I've had too much to drink? Or...
No, he didn't say that. He said that at roadside.
Yeah.
But in this case, he indicated that he couldn't do it. He could do it at his home, but he couldn't do it here. He couldn't take the test now, the breath test, but he'd be happy to take it in a couple hours. He said many things that were certainly incriminating, but they weren't the response asked for by the police, and I'd suggest to cause the police to forego gathering legitimate physical evidence because it's a drunk and he might say something.
Well, you don't need to forego the physical evidence. The question is whether the statements are admissible as well as the physical evidence.
That's correct. But again, if someone confesses during the gathering of legitimate testimonial evidence or legitimate demonstrative evidence, I suggest there's no purpose served by excluding that confession or incriminating statement any more than if it was during a lineup and he blurts out, during a search warrant and he blurts it out, or routine sobriety testing and he blurts it out.
How much damage do you suppose it would be done to the program if you had to give Miranda warnings as soon as you got him to the station house?
I think the damage is shown by the Thompson case in Pennsylvania, one of the Superior Court's line of cases where they did, in response to the decision in this case, give Miranda warnings at the outset. The accused then became, in the words of the court, obscene and belligerent when he refused to cooperate with these physical tests because they had just told him he had the right to remain silent and have a lawyer present. And he didn't want to do that without his lawyer present. He became obscene and belligerent, and the court ended up suppressing the entire tape.
You just have that one instance, or is there some...
That's one instance that's found its way to the appellate courts. I suggest to you where you tell him you have the right to remain silent and have a lawyer present, you suspect him of being intoxicated in the first place, to expect that to do anything but confuse the individual is just not realistic. It serves no purpose. It protects no one. It does hamper the gathering of legitimate physical evidence, and I think would be a totally intolerable rule given the desire we all have.
Is it the experience in your state that successful prosecution of drunk driving cases is really difficult, very difficult?
Not with the booking cases. We have more than tripled our prosecution rate in conjunction with these centers. Police are more likely to cooperate in bringing the person in. The citizenry accepts it. The case is on videotape. It's a two-edged sword sometimes, but it's there, and I think the truth-finding process is served by it. Pennsylvania has a per se rule if the test is over a 0.10. So if we have the test, that often resolves the case. Not always, but often. In this case, we had no test, and everything else becomes the crux of the case.
But it's found to be effective.
Oh, yes. Yes, sir. Unless there are other questions, I'll reserve the remaining time.
Very well, Mr. Aiken. Mr. Moffitt, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, a distinction must be drawn in this case because of the crime involved. Driving under the influence is a unique offense in the sense that the state of the mind of the defendant is actually an element of the offense. The Commonwealth must prove for a conviction driving under the influence of alcohol to a degree that makes the person incapable of safe driving. Under the influence of alcohol is defined by the Pennsylvania courts as to include any mental or physical condition as a result of drinking that either makes the person unfit to drive or substantially impairs judgment, clearness of intellect, or normal faculties essential for safe driving. And Pennsylvania courts have defined substantial impairment to be diminution or enfeeblement, inability to exercise judgment, to deliberate, or to react prudently to changed circumstances.
How do you define testimonial?
I would define testimonial as anything that would disclose the contents of someone's mind, either a direct confession, or the inferences from the words themselves.
Well, how about asking the person the name and address?
Well, in some circumstances, the name and address may not be testimonial, may be considered, I would submit it would be testimonial because it discloses the contents of the mind. Sometimes it would not be interrogation, because it could be found to be incident to normal arrest and custody. However, in a drunk driving situation, where practically anything can disclose the contents of the mind and can be expected to produce an incriminating response, that then even asking the name and address without giving the Miranda warnings would be considered interrogation.
So you think here every single question that was put to this to your client was interrogation, and Miranda warnings were required before even asking the name and address?
Especially under the facts of this case, Your Honor, because not only had the police officer obtained this information at roadside, but the booking officer had obtained this information before they went on videotape.
Well, but you would take the position that it was required at roadside as well. Nothing could be asked
before
giving Miranda warnings.
At roadside, he would not yet be in custody, and the very first thing the officer normally does as he begins his investigation would be your name, address, driver's license. Excuse me?
He stopped him, didn't he?
The man was at the side of the road, and the police officer stopped, and then he pulled off, and the officer...
And so they stopped him?
Yes.
Well, what about if after he stopped, they ask him to walk a line?
If he's not yet been arrested, he wouldn't be in custody, and this court's decision in Berkemer would control and
supposing he was in custody or he had been arrested and they then ask him to walk a line.
Is that permissible?
Yes. Is the result of the walking the line admissible if he has not previously been given Miranda warnings?
That's not the issue in this case, Your Honor.
Well, it may not be, but I'm very interested in your answer to the question.
I think that it, under some circumstances, that could also be testimonial. If, for example, it discloses the man's inability to follow instructions, and one of the key parts of the coordination tests, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration instructions, is one of the key scoring points is, can this man follow directions? So that if he's walking the straight line, if he can't do that because he can't follow the directions or he can't remember the test, that yes, that can be testimonial also.
Well, it's because it discloses what you refer to as the contents of his mind?
Yes, it discloses his inability to reason. It discloses inability to remember, his intellect.
Do you regard that as a satisfactorily precise phrase, disclosing the contents of one's mind?
Well, not exactly, and it's hard to come up with a precise phrase because the other cases don't deal exactly with this issue. The only issue that I can see close is the insanity situation. Most other cases... whether or not I can reason doesn't really come into whether or not the crime can be proven.
How about the voice exemplar cases and the handwriting sample cases? Why do they not disclose the contents of one's mind?
In those cases, the person who is giving the sample is not trying to communicate anything to the person he's giving the sample to, nor are the law enforcement authorities attempting to get communication. They simply want the physical aspect, the normal sound of the voice, the normal way the handwriting is written, so that there's no communication.
Well, but it does take brain activity to produce that.
It takes some brain activity. I think that in past decisions of this court, the court has found that it to be so minimal as to be not considered because it's no conscious thought. And there's no, although there's brain activity, there's no intention to communicate.
There's certainly an intention to convey an idea. Is that what you mean by an intention?
There's no intention to convey an idea. And the times that samples like this have been allowed has always been a situation where it was for identity, not for elements of the crime.
What if you ask me to give a writing sample and I write, "The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog"? Now, I'm there communicating an idea, am I not?
That's right, and I do not think that, under my understanding of this Court's past decisions, that would not be permissible because that discloses, rather than you giving me a sentence, "The quick brown fox jumps over the log," to write, and I write what you tell me to write. If you pick what you write, and you decide how to spell it and what you pick, then that does disclose the mental thought process.
So the handwriting sample cases depend upon whether or not the defendant is told what to write, which is all right, or said, "Write anything you want," which is not all right?
I would submit that's correct. Both United States versus Wade and Dionisio and Gilbert all involved situations where the person who gave the sample was given something and said, "Write this, speak this."
So would it be all right here to ask the defendant to recite the alphabet?
It would not, because it would involve his intellectual capacity to put the letters together, to remember what comes after
it's
B.
It's just like being given a sentence to write.
Except that if he forgets how to write the sentence, he can look on the paper and see it to write it. In fact, there's a case, United States versus Campbell, which is the Court of Appeals, is not this circuit, where the individual had to spell the exemplar, where the exemplar was dictated to them, but they had to pick the spelling. But that was found to be testimonial because the person conveyed the contents of his thought process, this is how I spell the word. And so similarly, if you're asked to recite the ABCs, again, that's not this case, but if you're asked to recite the ABCs and you have to pick what comes after D and how many letters are there, that discloses exactly what the Fifth Amendment was intended to protect.
May I question that, Mr. Maffitt? It seems to me when you talk about the contents of the mind, you can think of it as a warehouse with the contents of which are all sorts of information, data, facts, and the like. There's a separate question is how well the machinery in the warehouse is working. And that is, does it, if you're asked to recite the alphabet and all the rest of it, how is the mind functioning? How's the nervous system functioning? Why is that different from Justice White's example, asking him to walk? That tells you how the nervous system functions. It doesn't reveal any of the material that's stored in the warehouse. And I think contents of the mind means something stored there, not how it works.
But the function of the mind is an element of this offense, and by asking the man
sure,
to
but it might be a function of the but I don't know how that advances the argument.
Well, but by asking the man to calculate the date of his sixth birthday, unlike walking the straight line, he then is disclosing information that incriminates him from his mouth, from his thought process.
Well, but from his mind, but he's showing how his mind works. It works in a way that the law says is an element of the crime.
That's correct, and I would argue that is protected by the Fifth Amendment. This court in Estelle versus Smith, in that case, the psychiatrist took what the man said to him and decided that man's mind worked in such a way that he was dangerous to society and deserved the death penalty. And this is...
That conclusion rested in part on how the mind worked and in part on the facts that were revealed during the discussion with the psychiatrist. And they're both aspects were there.
Yeah. Well, this case, to a certain extent, has the same thing, because the inability to calculate the sixth birthday or to get your age right reveals how Mr. Muniz's mind worked.
Yeah.
I would submit in similar fashion.
On that basis, I would suppose that if you ask him what's your age and he answers and he slurs.
Yes.
You could use the information he gave you, how old you are, but you couldn't show on videotape or have the audio part showing that he slurred, because that shows how he's speaking, how his mind is letting his tongue work.
I would agree, Your Honor, and part of the problem is that sometimes you have a combination of testimonial.
So you could get a voice exemplar, except it couldn't include a slurring.
Well, part of the problem, particularly in a situation where the intoxication is the crime, you get a situation where you have a mixture of physical and testimonial in the same thing. You have a mixture of the physical part of the control of the tongue with the thoughts of the mind. And it's something that I would submit to the court, you can't cut the line. You can't exclude the testimonial.
So the slurring is inadmissible, in your view. The fact that he talks in a slurred manner is inadmissible without Miranda warnings.
I would submit that it is, Your Honor.
And
again, that's not the situation here. But
for the same reason that walking, inability to walk a line would be inadmissible, in your view?
Well, again, inability to walk a line... The problem becomes that there are both physical and testimonial aspects. There are the aspects that show the diminished ability to reason, and there are aspects that show the diminished ability to walk.
Let's just take the typical situation where he's told to walk a line, shown how, and in the view of the police doesn't succeed. And then you say you have a video and audio of that.
Is that admissible, in your view? How he walked that line? Is that admissible?
Is his inability to do it that he doesn't follow the
instructions. Well, there's the video.
He does it perfect, but falls off the line.
You don't. The police simply say, you didn't walk a straight line. And the video confirms that he didn't walk a straight line.
That would be much closer to strictly physical, and so would be permitted, because that's more towards the exemplar situation where you're looking at a person's normal gait, normal voice.
It's physical, but the mind's a physical thing. The reason he doesn't walk the line is not because there's something wrong with his foot, it's because it's something wrong with his mind.
That's true. However, if he's walking the line, it primarily would show his inability to control his physical features. It depends.
The inability of his mind. It shows how his mind is working.
That's correct.
You wouldn't limit the Constitution, just to mention it, does say that what we're talking about here is compelling a person in a criminal case to be a witness against himself, to be a witness. Don't you think that sort of focuses on ideas, on the conveying of whether your mind can control your foot or not, but thoughts, ideas. Isn't that what witnesses do?
Yes, and ideas are involved in this case. Again, this case doesn't involve, we didn't challenge the physical coordination tests. We merely challenged the responses that Mr. Muniz made. As far as walking the straight line and the one-leg stand, we didn't make any challenge to those items.
Yeah, but you're now saying that might have been a mistake. I mean, you're carrying your position to the point that even where what he says does not disclose thoughts in his mind, but even if it just discloses whether his mind can control anything, that might be bad.
I think that you'd have to go on a case-by-case basis.
I'm sure.
Well, you get the combination of the physical and testimonial, and unless, if I think of a specific instance, then I can say, well, I believe this to be physical or testimonial. But the idea is, when Mr. Muniz tries to walk a straight line, or when Mr. Muniz tried to answer these questions, he was trying to convey the idea to the booking center personnel, I'm not drunk. I'm all right. I didn't commit a crime. That's the idea he's trying to convey. The Commonwealth, in trying to show these things, is trying to convey the impression, he is drunk. He has committed a crime. So that there is an idea, even when he tries to walk the straight line, he's trying to communicate, I'm okay. I haven't had too much to drink.
And I don't know that that's right.
Well,
I guess in the same way you can say when you give a voice exemplar, you're trying to communicate, my voice sounds like this. I mean, in that sense, everything's a communication of something in your mind.
But with the voice exemplar, again, the individual is merely asked to repeat a phrase or a sentence or whatever it is.
Communicating my voice sounds like this as much as your client would be communicating, you know, I can control my feet.
Well, the exemplar cases have always been for the identity of the person rather than the elements of the crime itself.
Why should that make any difference when we're talking about the availability of the privilege against self-incrimination?
Because identification is not the physical identification, Justice Scalia said, the Fifth Amendment protects the person from being a witness against themselves. Identification doesn't normally make that person a witness against himself.
Well, but that's because the cases have said identification in this sense is not testimonial. Not that it's not an element of the crime. Not that it's not helpful in getting the person convicted.
But if you identify me, that doesn't help you to convict me. It helps you to convict me in the sense that you may know who the suspect is. But the police, the law enforcement authorities still must take and develop their evidence on their own and make their case, as opposed to having me participate in making their case.
Well, but if we know that a person with a certain kind of handwriting forged this check, and it turns out that you have required by the grand jury to give a handwriting exemplar, have that kind of handwriting, that is very obviously a link in the prosecution's case against you. So that if it were testimonial, you would surely have a right to object.
It is a link in the case, but it's not the case. It again may provide the identity of the individual. Would have
you say the difference then is whether it's just a link in the case as opposed to the case?
Well, and a person's identity is always a link in the case, because even if you have really strong proof, if you don't have if you can't prove who it was, you don't have a case. But you don't have but identity doesn't help prove the elements of the crime. For example, this court in I believe California versus Byers said that an individual had to stop after he had an accident and stay there, and he was by staying there he was divulging his identity, but that it didn't help the Commonwealth prove their case because they still had to prove that he had committed some criminal violation. There were other parts to the opinion. I agree, but that's my understanding of the difference between identity and actually helping convict yourself. There can be no question that calculating the sixth birthday or the other things that Mr. Muniz was asked to do, again, show either his ability to recall a reason or his inability to do that, and his clearness of intellect, judgment, and mental state. The fact that that he didn't direct, that, in other words, that the Commonwealth didn't want to use the date of his sixth birthday for the actual proof of when the date of his sixth birthday is of no moment, as this court decided in Estelle versus Smith. The impressions, inferences from what was said can be just as protected and just as testimonial as the direct words. It cannot be argued in this case that any of Mr. Muniz's responses were voluntary. The Superior Court found, as a matter of fact, both that the utterances were clearly compelled and that none of them were voluntary, and furthermore, where a defendant is in custody and he hasn't been given his Miranda warnings, there's a presumption of compulsion.
You really think that there was a finding that these were actually compelled, or just that there was it was equivalent to in custody interrogation that would demand Miranda warnings?
There was a finding that
all of what needed to have happened, as I understand it, was that the Miranda warnings should have been given first.
That's right, Your Honor, and perhaps I misspoke. There was a finding that his comments were not were prompted. In other words, were either in response to direct questions or conduct on the part of the booking officer. Not so much that they were compelled in that sense, but this court has in the past held that where a defendant is questioned in custody and without Miranda warnings, that there's a presumption of compulsion. The occurrences in this case can't be argued to be tantamount to merely attendant to arrest and custody, because it goes far beyond what normally happens and what this court has found to be attendant to arrest and custody. This is a situation far beyond fingerprinting or photographing or a blood or a breath test. This was an investigative process. The booking center process itself is designed to gather evidence. You have a situation where not only is the defendant separated from the public, he's separated from the rest of the police department. Only drunk driving suspects are taken to these booking centers. The defendant is not asked, would you like to take some coordination tests? He has said, now we're going to give you some tests. Would you come over here? There are lines painted on the floor. It is well lit. The videotape and breath machines are in place. He has given these physical sobriety tests as part of the investigation. The petitioner in their brief said that as far as the implied consent law, that was somehow to be fair to the defendant, to make sure that he understood. But Pennsylvania law currently is that for a valid test or a valid refusal to be admitted into evidence, they don't need to show that the defendant understood what he was told about the implied consent law, or that his choice in either taking the test or not taking the test was knowing and voluntary. They merely have to show that they told that it was a legitimate arrest, they asked him to take the test, and that they told him what the consequences would be if he refused.
To introducing what happened at the roadside?
No, I did not, Your Honor.
So anything that any of the tests there were admissible?
That's correct, because he was not arrested until he was placed in the police car and actually placed under arrest. A case that can be analogized to this case was the Court of Appeals case of United States versus Hinckley. It involved the assassination of, or attempted assassination of, President Reagan. Now, the FBI took Mr. Hinckley and for about 20 or 25 minutes asked him questions concerning where his parents lived, his address, did he have girlfriends, where did he work, how far had he gone in school, those sorts of things. It was nothing even as overt as this case because it didn't have directly to do with the elements of the offense that he was charged with. But the court found that since the agents were aware that there was a likelihood that there would be an insanity defense, the responses were inadmissible because it was reasonably likely to, or the FBI was aware that their questions were reasonably likely to lead to an incriminating response. And that's exactly the situation in this case, where it's pretty close, because you have the officer at roadside who's testified that he observes odor of alcohol, bloodshot eyes, poor coordination, trouble producing license and registration. In fact, he told him to stay at the side of the road until he sobered up. According to the officer, practically every contact at the side of the road produced some sort of an incriminating response. And from that point on, law enforcement certainly should have known that whatever they asked Mr. Muniz was likely to elicit an incriminating response. And then more of the same at the booking center. He can't even give them his address. He has to look at his wallet. He gets his age wrong. This is all before the sixth birthday question. Is it reasonably likely to expect that a drunk driving suspect, on being asked to perform these field sobriety tests, when he can't do them, will provide some sort of an explanation which will end up being incriminating? If the procedure in this case is not construed by this court to be interrogation, I would argue that the privilege against self-incrimination would be substantially eroded. You can't expect a defendant who's upset by the arrest itself, without counsel, he does not know of his right not to have the conversation, to make a choice based on the consequences of these seemingly innocent questions and instructions. Because the questions on their face to the defendant are statistical and may seem to him to be to ensure he understood, without being told that he has a right to remain silent or that whatever he says might be used against him. He has no way to know that he doesn't have to answer and that his responses may be used later at trial to convict him.
Statements during the testing, the so-called voluntary statements during the testing, could he have possibly have thought that he had to say those things?
Well, I think most of the statements during the testing were, again, he was trying to show, to communicate that he was not intoxicated because he said things like, I can't walk this way even when I'm at home, or I can't walk this way even when I'm at work, or I can't, my legs are not so good. So there were things that he was trying to explain why he couldn't do the test that they asked him to do. In fact, on the video...
Well, the audio of all of that was excluded, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes. At one point on the video, he even said, he was told, well, we'll read you your Miranda warnings later. And he said, well, something to the effect of, I know you people are pretty fair about it. I mean, he was relying on them to be fair with him in their investigation. He had no idea that what they were doing was gathering evidence from what he said, to convict him. And this would not, if you...
Well, he didn't think that the test he was given had some bearing on whether he would be held?
He may have, but as far as his words, I can't tell you. He wouldn't know without being told that, and especially his statement, I know you people will be pretty fair about it, is an illustration that he thought that something else was going on.
Well, it could just as well have meant he thought the police would not distort the results, they would be even-handed, not that they weren't doing anything to build a case against
him. I suppose that's another fair inference. If the court were to sustain the Pennsylvania Superior Court, it would not appreciably affect the way these booking procedures are done. The defendant can still be asked his name and his address and any other biographical information that they need, but if they don't read him his rights, they just can't use that part in evidence. And I would argue that as far as whether or not it would make any difference if you did read the man his rights at the beginning, that in fact it would not. It's been my practice in Cumberland County since the time of this decision that now, in fact, they do read him his rights as soon as the man comes to the police station. And again, just from my practice, it doesn't make any, it hasn't made any difference on whether the people say something or not.
Is Cumberland County just to the west of Dauphin County?
You say you
practice in Cumberland County, but your office, I see, is in Harris.
They're very close. They're within, across the river is Cumberland County from Dauphin. The advantage of Miranda has always been its clarity, its bright line. The police, the prosecutors, the lower courts know what must be done for questioning and under what circumstances statements are admissible. If you make an exception to the facts of this case, it's going to lead to a lot of litigation, with the end result would be an elaborate set of rules and exceptions and distinctions. And nobody, not the police, not the prosecutors, not the courts, are going to know with any certainty as to any particular situation whether or not the interrogation is permissible. If you allow the kind of conduct or questioning or the process that occurred here, you put a premium on the police devising these indirect interrogation methods, these tricky things of the sixth birthday question and other similar indirect questionings. Because the what happened at the booking center is actually, if it actually incriminated and was just as deadly to Mr. Muniz as if he'd have been asked, are you drunk? And for all intents and purposes, his responses said, I am drunk. And I would argue that because the utterances disclosed the contents of his mind, his reasoning ability, that they were testimonial and protected by the Fifth Amendment, and since he was subject to interrogation without Miranda warnings, that the audio portion of the videotape was correctly ruled inadmissible. If there are no other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Maffitt. Mr. Aiken, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I would suggest that what the Court's being asked to do by Mr. Maffitt is to extend Miranda to cover situations of custodial sobriety testing that it is not designed for, and that instead of the contrary, trying to devise a set of rights that an intoxicated suspect will understand that tells him he has a right to remain silent, except you've got to do these tests, would be completely unworkable. Because the tests are designed to get physical, demonstrative evidence, and that's all they're designed to get, I suggest the present law covers that and covers it quite clearly, and Miranda warning should not be extended to apply to this situation. Unless the Court has other questions, I'll go the rest of my
time. Thank you, Mr. Aiken. The case is submitted.